It is just past 7:34 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiecher. Hurricane Florence is now barreling towards the Atlantic coast of the United States, expected to make landfall sometime Thursday night. As of this moment, wind speeds are about 130 miles per hour. And the weather modeling suggests that once it hits land, it could just kind of sit there. In other words, what we're looking at is a storm with the wind intensity of a Hurricane Katrina that would follow the same pattern of just sitting in place and dumping tons and tons of rain that Harvey did. Quite likely, it will be the worst hurricane impact in U.S. history. Yesterday, President Trump called a press conference to talk about hurricane preparations. And in the course of it, he gave himself an enormous pat on the back for the major hurricane that hit the U.S. about this time last year, Hurricane Maria. Speaking of the government's response to Maria's landfall in Puerto Rico, he said, quote, "I actually think it was one of the best jobs," called the U.S. response, quote, "an incredible unsung success." If you've been following our coverage, you know the island, most of it, was months and months and months without power. Some parts of the island still have not had full electricity restored. And last month, Puerto Rico increased its death toll estimate from that storm to 2,975. As we're getting ready for what is to come in the mid-Atlantic, we thought we should take inventory of what happened with the last major storm under this administration. Antonia Yuhas spoke to Puerto Rican investigative journalist Omaya Sosa Pascual. Here's the interview.
You're listening to Upfront. I'm Antonia Yuhas. Originating from a tropical wave, Maria became a tropical storm on September 16, 2017. It went on to become one of the most devastating and destructive hurricanes on record, leaving a path of virtually unparalleled destruction in its wake. Among the areas hardest hit was Puerto Rico. Our guest today, Omaya Sosa, is an investigative journalist and new media entrepreneur with 20 years of experience. She's the founding co-director of Puerto Rico's Center for Investigative Journalism and co-founder of Noticel.com, a digital news outlet. She joins us from San Juan. Thanks for being with us, Omaya.
Thanks so much for having me, Antonia.
So in addition to having to deal with the consequences of Hurricane Maria as an individual stuck in the wake of the storm, you are also addressing it as an investigative journalist. Can you just start with telling us what it was like when the storm hit and your experiences on the first day?
Well, we were just, actually, I should start the day before. I was really scared for the first time in my life. I've been through many hurricanes, and, you know, it's normal for us to face devastating hurricanes and even to go for a couple of weeks without electricity. I've been there before, but this time we were certain it was different. It was going to cover the whole island, and it was a Category 5 hurricane. It actually became a Category 4 right before hitting Puerto Rico, so it was just a couple of miles off a Category 5 hurricane. So for the first time, I was thinking, you know, this could be really, really bad. I have a 3-year-old kid, and we even got her. So I got her a life vest just in case water was so high. I live near the coast that we had to swim or leave the house, you know, in some kind of it was really, really worrisome for everybody. The day that storm hit, my home actually held up pretty good, and we were, you know, okay. It was, but what we were seeing through the windows was really devastating. We saw all the panels flying around. We saw all the debris and the trees and everything falling apart from our windows. And when we went out, it was that when we really had a reckoning of what went on. Everything was burned. It's like gray or brown. Puerto Rico, for all of those who haven't been here, is a very lush green place. We are a tropical island. So to go out and see everything just like a fire went through the whole island, and all the electricity posts were on the ground. it was really shocking. It looked like a bomb had fallen there, you know. So at that point, I really didn't even know where to begin. We had water, a couple of feet of water right in front of my gate in my street to go out to the main street. So we couldn't even leave the place. And, you know, it was just neighbors looking at each other thinking, now what? Mm. Now what do we do?
What did you do?
Well, that afternoon we couldn't do much. We just walked around. It was not possible to drive around anywhere. And you saw everybody just trying to get out of their homes. And it was about 6 o'clock when we started just looking at the streets and seeing what went on. Night was about to fall. So we thought, you know, it's not a good idea to try and move from here in any kind of way. I mean, that streets were totally blocked anyway. We had no electricity. We had no communications. The radio stations were all down except for one. So in the end, we said, you know, let's just all stay at home until tomorrow. And tomorrow we'll see how we can contact our other loved ones, our other family members, our friends, and see, you know, what can be done. I received a call from a U.S. outlet, not a call, like a text. It was one of the last things I was able to receive in my cell phone, like, you know, minutes after the hurricane left, asking me if I could start working. And I was like, you know what? I don't even know. You cannot drive. I don't know if the gas stations are open. I don't know where to leave my kid. You know, right now, I don't know if I can just leave my home like this at night. So in the end, since I work for my local outlet too, I thought, let me stand by and see what goes on tomorrow with the Center for Investigative Journalism in Puerto Rico and how we can regroup.
And then you did start working. How many days was it before you were able to, you know, transition from your own survival for your own family, your own neighborhood, your own community, into turning to your job as an investigative journalist?
Let's say formally 2 days, but actually it really took me like 12 to 24 hours to start working in my mind, right? I started talking right away with people that are my neighbors. Some of them are doctors or people that work in hospitals. And the things I was hearing here and there, it was all like, you know, 2 centuries ago, or rumors. This person said that hospital didn't have any electricity, that people were dying. I started to hear these things, you know, about 1 or 2 days after the Hurricane Maria struck, and I started taking my own personal notes. On day number 3, I just decided that was it. I had no way of communicating with our editor and director or between each other in terms of the journalists of the team. But, you know, I couldn't take out my car, but I decided, I had no internet, but I decided I had to do something. So, on day 3, I just put on my backpack. I heard there was a place where there was a little bit of Wi-Fi signal because that was a fiber optic company, and they had opened up like a hotspot for people to be able to at least connect and maybe try and talk to people outside of Puerto Rico or something like that. And that was like 8 to 10 blocks away from my home. And I decided just to put on my backpack and walk there and see if I could communicate with someone. Right away, I started receiving messages in my WhatsApp account on my cell phone. And it was some of the other journalists of our team trying to do the same thing. Specifically one that said, you know what? I guess we're all on the same boat. I think we have to regroup. I'm proposing to whoever gets this message, let's meet tomorrow morning and let's start working on our stories, even if we don't have fuel for our cars. Whoever can make it, let's make it somewhere, you know? And I answered, you know, there's a place here with a small hotspot that has offered a little office space for journalists that want to start working. And that's how we started. Next day, a group of us met, and we all had already been working in our minds on possible stories. And that took 2 hours, and we just took to the streets and started, or walking or carpooling, whoever had fuel, just took each other, the other journalists to the places where they had to work. There we started to find out also that the government had a command center where they opened up a space for journalists. They had electricity, they had slow and bad Wi-Fi, but it was a way to start working. So in the end, we established a temporary office at the government emergency center.
And you write that you started seeing a trend, as you just alluded to, quite early on, which was a lot of older people with health conditions who couldn't receive life-sustaining service because of the lack of electricity and communication in their homes, in shelters, even in hospitals, and that you were starting to document on your own not only these threatening health conditions, but deaths.
Yes, that first week, the governor of Puerto Rico declared that there had been 16 casualties. And in these conversations that started a couple of days after the hurricane, I told you about doctors and personnel from, different rescue agencies, policemen, rescue workers, even people from funeral homes were telling me that, they were seeing many more deaths than the government was accounting for. Especially doctors were telling me, you know what? In my hospital alone, I had 9 deaths in 48 hours. And another doctor would tell me, I had 4 more. And I said, you know what? This doesn't match. We have 78 municipalities. If I have half a dozen doctors telling me they're seeing each one of them 5 to 9 deaths daily or every 2 days, it's impossible that we have 16 hurricane-related deaths. And they were talking to me about the chaos in many of the hospitals that had no power, like almost 100% of Puerto Rico. And their generators were starting to fail. They didn't have enough fuel for such a prolonged blackout. So after a couple of days, hospitals started having some right away, others after, a couple of days or a week started having very serious trouble with their electricity. And as you well know, there's many people that are outside of the hospitals that need electricity for life-supporting services. And then you have the people that are really extremely sick at the hospitals that totally need electricity all the time. So, many of these deaths were happening due to the lack of electricity for life-sustaining devices, for medicines, to keep medicines refrigerated, for example, insulin for diabetics. And we just started doing a very primitive exercise of creating our own database of all the cases that I was getting from several different sources. By September 28th, we already had 60, let's say, cases documented. And we expect that we could estimate that it was possibly hundreds of people that had died because of the hurricane.
And you wrote that since the government had no official statistics and was still quoting this ridiculously low figure, that the only way to confirm deaths with names and evidence was to visit the towns in person and get firsthand accounts. What was that reporting like?
It was draining. It was exhausting. I started on my own, and I quickly noticed that it wouldn't be possible. We were able to assign a second reporter. But for those first 3 months, it was only me and another reporter taking to the towns. As difficult as it was to get there, you couldn't even make an interview by phone. So figure this out. And I'm talking about October, November, 2 months after the hurricane. You couldn't call a mayor. You couldn't call sources. Many times you had to just drive there and see if you could, you know, talk to people, because you maybe had signal in San Juan that things got a little better after a month or a month and a half. But in the remote towns, there was no signal, so you had nobody to call. And it was a very enlightening exercise to go to these towns and find out how, you know, the old way you could just do good journalism, taking notes, interviewing people, and getting the facts together. Many times we had to go back a second time. So with the data you got the first day, the second time you could actually go and find the victim's family. Most of the cases they were actually right. They were true, and family members had not been had so much hardship. Mm. We interviewed two families in October that say third week or fourth week that had the dead family member. One had it 4 days dead in his home. Another one had his mom 9 days dead in his home because nobody would go pick up the corpse. So that, you know, gives you an idea of how surreal things were here in Puerto Rico.
I mean, that's what I was thinking. It's not just the difficulty of the legwork, which must have just been exhausting, but you're going from house to house to house trying to document death. And how hard that must have been emotionally, and the stories, how hard it was for the people to share the stories, but also to report on them.
Yes, it was really, when I said draining, it's more emotionally, you know, it's people are really affected. For you, it's another death story, but for the family, it's their loved one, their family member, and all the hardships they went through. And that's not an interview you make really quickly, or let's move to the next one. And in the end, when we saw it was dozens and hundreds, it became a task that we said at some point in November, we have to seek a way to make this, automatize this in some kind of way so we can really document the high volume of cases. Because, you know, if we're going to interview one by one, we will never get to the bottom of this and to the extension of how many deaths seem to have occurred and kept on occurring in Puerto Rico past December. You know, the peak was those first 3 months, but in January 2018, February, March, even in April, we still have reported deaths that are due to situations that had to do with the hurricane.
And so what was it like, you know, in the early days of the storm? You also, fairly shortly after, not only do you have the governor of Puerto Rico still asserting, you know, that the death toll is so low, but then you have the president of the United States coming and doing his now infamous press conference where he's laughing and tossing paper towels and being almost giddy at how, in his words, how, you know, well everything is going. You know, how surreal was that to see that disconnect?
That was totally insulting. It was really insulting to everybody here. And it was very insulting from President Trump, but even more insulting from Governor Rosselló, that was here, that knew what was going on and just accepted this and did not confront the president with anything, did not say anything. So I don't know if you know, but 4 hours after the president left, they revised the death toll and almost doubled it. So you can imagine that's one of the moments where the transparency problems began for Dr. Rosselló.
So also then, in the wake of your great reporting, there has been a wave of studies that then started off from that reporting and then have built on it, looking at academic studies, including one that came out from Harvard earlier in the year, estimating that as many as 8,000 people have died in Puerto Rico as a result of Hurricane Maria. Even more recently, a new study came out by the Millikan Institute of Public Health at George Washington University, and this was a report that the governor of Puerto Rico commissioned the center to do. And this estimate puts out as many as 3,000 people may have died as a result of the storm, significantly lower than the Harvard study, but 45% higher than what Puerto Rico was previously saying. Can you tell me what you think about these studies and how they're being conducted? And, you know, if you think that the appropriate attention is now being put on not only really, you know, it's one thing to lose a family member to a storm. It's another thing to have that family, to have that death not exist because it's not being officially counted. It's almost an erasure of the experience. So, you know, what it means to have more of this counting happening, accounting happening, and then how good you think these different studies are at this point?
Well, it's definitely a victory, at least for the government to finally recognize that it's not 64 deaths, which is still their official list of names, but that they are saying, you know what, officially we're going to say we estimate it's about 3,000, even though they don't have those names, right? So that's something important for people to know. All these studies are projections, estimate, basically mathematical formulas where they can analyze what they call the excess death, how many more deaths Puerto Rico received compared to previous years. And, you know, they've been happening since November 21st was the first one that was already saying that it was about 1,000 deaths. And what makes you angry is that why did it take so long for the government to come up with a correction when lives could have been saved, right? Because if you already had a Penn State study in November saying, you know what, it's November, and in September and October, we already have about 1,000 excess deaths. Why? Those are the questions that we have to really insist on the government of Puerto Rico, Congress, federal government. Why did it take so long to recognize the problem? It's also some of these studies are better than others. The Harvard study gives a very big range. They say it could have been between 800 to 8,000 deaths, you know, and that's a huge difference. But they pick this number about 4,000 deaths, the median, as what they think deaths were between September and December of 2017. So when you look at them, you have to see they take different ranges of dates. They use different methodology, and that they bring to the table different things, but they all bring important things to the table. The Harvard study in particular does a good job documenting some of the reasons that led to this high mortality. The study by George Washington, that was the one the government of Puerto Rico commissioned, actually, you know, leaves us really with a bad taste, because we just got their number for a different range of dates, and we do not get anything about what the causes were, what the reasons for the high mortality were. And it took 8 months, you know, that the reason for these studies to be done actually are to have insight on what happened so you can prevent deaths next time. And today we are in the peak of the hurricane season. We finally get the study commissioned by the government of Puerto Rico, and it says nothing about how we can prevent deaths next time. So we are exactly in the same place or worse off than in September 2017.
I mean, that's what I was going to ask you. We are in hurricane season again now. It's almost the 1 year anniversary of when Hurricane Maria hit. And you're saying things are worse than they were last year?
Yes, they are, because Hurricane Maria left particularly the electrical infrastructure in a very bad shape. And we've had, you know, some, it's been kind of fixed. But it was just repairs to for people to get their power back. It's not that the whole system was reconstructed. It is in a much more fragile position than where it was in 2017 in September. So actually, we've had many experts say if we get even a lower category hurricane, you know, that we're all going to lose power and we're back to square zero. the infrastructure of hospitals have suffered a lot too. And they've been able to, you know, fix some things. But it's not that there has been a strong reconstruction of infrastructure in Puerto Rico. No, things are just hanging in there.
So are there many more financial and other resources needing to come from the federal government, come from other people of the United States to help Puerto Rico rebuild?
Yes, definitely. The bulk of the federal aid to begin with has not even arrived. And it's been almost a year that the government says it expects the bulk of it to arrive in 2019. But it's been very, very slow. So most of the reconstruction has not begun. The part of the housing is just starting to take off. And I don't even know what's going to happen with the electrical infrastructure. Honestly, nobody does. So that's a public corporation. It's in very bad financial shape. And, you know, the talks of the government is that they want to sell, privatize it, the corporation. So people are really, Puerto Ricans here are in despair and are really worried about what will happen if we get another strong hurricane passing through.
Well, you wrote, why do we keep investigating and reporting on Hurricane Maria's death toll? The answer is simple, to save lives. And we thank you very much for that reporting and wish you the best of luck in your continued reporting. Our guest, Omaya Souza, is an investigative journalist and new media entrepreneur with 20 years of experience. She's the founding co-director of Puerto Rico's Center for Investigative Journalism and co-founder of Noticel.com, a digital news outlet. She joined us today from San Juan in Puerto Rico. Thanks so much for being with us, Omaya.
Thanks so much for having us, Antonia.